And let me introduce my guest here today that we have in the studio on this October 22nd. We're here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, Assistant Professor of Public Health here at the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University and Indie Reader contributor. That's dead, isn't it?
Not yet.
Still going. Good. All right. I thought it died. Good. And activist for equitable redevelopment throughout Baltimore City. Good to have you in the studio, Lawrence.
Howdy.
Dr. Carsonia Wise. Whitehead. Kay Whitehead is Assistant Professor of Communication and Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland. Good to have you here, Kay.
Always a pleasure.
And Dr. Richard Vatz. Rick Vatz, Professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson University, author of the only authentic book of persuasion. Always good to have you here, Rick.
Instructional Welcome. Leadership and Professional Development. That's my new department.
We'll get that right next time and get his title on this thing. Sorry about that, Rick.
No, that's all right. I just want to say that because I'm now in the College of Education and where I couldn't be happier.
So, and you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us. And you can also log on to our Facebook page. So let me start with this quote that I found interesting from the U.S. Constitution. We've had this giant debate over the debt ceiling. The Tea Party on the right made this huge push. Some may say that at least they stood up for what they believed and made a fight. As that other guest on the set, we wish we could see people left making a similar fight standing up, which they don't do. But the right clearly did stood up for what they believed in. But there is this part. It is. Let me read this. This is from July 9th, 1868. The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. This is the 14th Amendment, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, passed by the Radical Republican Congress of 1868 when all of the racist Southern Democrats were not in Congress. So they passed this as well as they passed, at that time, the Homestead Act, the national currency, the Transcontinental Railroad, higher education, and the end of slavery. What does that act say to you, this 14th Amendment, Section 4? The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law shall not be questioned.
Well, the debt may not be questioned, but I think the president can be questioned. You know, if you've seen the movie 12 Years a Slave, which is really tremendous, there's a portion in there where they tell the main character, you know, show me your papers. And that's what they've been doing with this president ever since he arrived in office. We don't believe you're born in this country. Show me your papers. You know, you're a Kenyan Muslim socialist, you know, ideologue who's coming to shove stuff down our throat. Show me your papers. And that's the thing that I think has caused a lot of consternation in this country, where you have a faction that's willing to move the country backward rather than allow a black man in the White House to move the country forward.
Rick Vatz.
Well, I don't know that when you're questioning the amount of the debt, you're questioning the validity of the debt. I mean, the fact is that we've got a debt climbing now to $17 trillion. It's going to be climbing to $20 trillion and $25 trillion. And I also want to say that in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, he said that George Bush was unpatriotic for allowing the debt to get to $9 trillion. We're now approaching twice that. And there ought to be some reporter who would say to the president, Mr. President, if George Bush was unpatriotic for allowing the debt to rise to $9 trillion, are you unpatriotic for doubling that debt? You never seem to want to talk about it. You never seem to want to talk about the deficit except to say that it's currently almost halved. But the fact is that it's going up. And the debt is going up. And is this unpatriotic? Why wouldn't there be some lonely reporter who would say that to the president?
Well, it says a couple of things
to me.
Yes, please. One of the things that it says to me that's so obvious is that people are not aware of what's in the Constitution. I think that people don't read it. If you stop them on the street and you talk to them about this, they would be very concerned over the national debt and they wouldn't understand what the Constitution says. There was a great article in the LA Times that came out on the 16th that said that people don't know that the debt is actually going down rather than up, that we've always had a national debt in this country. And when you look at the period of time we didn't have a national debt, it was in 1835. That if we've always had a national debt and the economy continues to get bigger, then what do we do with this? I was listening to talk radio this morning, And there were a number of people talking about the Tea Party. I mean, the Tea Party makes people very angry, though it's really a small percentage of the Republican Party. You would think it's 100% of the people, the way they get people angry. But that caller after caller said that America is no longer lily white. America is changing and the Tea Party doesn't understand it. And I sat there thinking, well, even though America is black, brown, and white now, how do we deal with these old problems? We have a new America, but we have old problems. We have a debt. Whether or not it's going down or going up, it is a huge debt, and it's affecting all of us. I understand the debate around Barack Obama, but I try to push people past that. I'm thinking at this point, when I look at him, I see our president and I see our debt, and I'm looking for him to come up with some solutions, black, brown, or white. We need solutions to these problems rather than still focusing on his race. Who can't seem to move past that now?
And it seems that, well, I think we, in some ways, we the question of race in Barack Obama is a difficult one because on the one hand, you can't get past, I mean, the reality is some of it's there, but the other reality is that there are a lot of people in the African-American community who like Tavis Smiley and others who question Barack Obama pretty vociferously about what he's not doing as a president of the United States from the progressive view of what's going on. And the Tea Party itself, I mean, they may be a smaller group than the Republican Party, but they are large in number. They represent a huge opinion, especially in the more conservative and right-wing elements, right-wing parts of the United States of America that are mostly white, saying we're worried about where America's going. I thought about this on my way driving home the other day. And Rick, you can jump in on this. Then we'll go to the phones. I mean, that the whole notion of community control, of people controlling their own lives as states' rights, is a big part of what the Tea Party advocates are talking about.
That's true.
And there have been people on the left who would agree that they want to see more control in the local communities. The problem is that what's – and you can challenge this, right?
But
maybe you will this part. Maybe you won't. I don't know. But the problem is that states' rights movement and that whole movement around local control was wrapped up in slavery and the racism to justify what happened in America, which is part of the problem. The battle over states' rights, and that's why I think it gets all twisted, and that's part of the twisted part of all this that I think that people have a hard time parsing out and addressing. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I just don't think that the attacks on the Tea Party is being racist. Look, anytime you have a large minority of people, I'm talking about the Tea Party here, you can always find individual elements who are utterly irresponsible in their rhetoric. And that doesn't mean that typifies the movement. You know, if you look at the progressives in this country, there are those who are so left-wing that they believe in government control. They believe in totalitarian government. But that's a very tiny percentage. And to characterize an entire group of people by their most extreme elements, I think, is basically unfair. And so I think that when people talk about the accusations of the president not being born in America and other crazy sorts of accusations, it really is irrelevant because there's no major opinion center in any major minority group in our country that believes these slurs on the president. The question is the president a responsible leader? And I think he is not. And part of the reason is that he couldn't care less about the debt rising. He wants government control over everything. And I think that he is an utterly very, very attractive, very fluent, very rhetorically engaging, utterly irresponsible president.
But there are communities that I go in that I cannot say that. That if I want to criticize the president, I'm seen as being a traitor. And I say, if you take out the color of his skin, why can't we look at his politics and really kind of hold him up to the same scrutiny that we were allowed to hold Bush up to and say whether or not he is doing the job that we have elected him to do? I think it gets confusing. I mean, it's easy to talk about parsing out race, but when you make comments like we want our country back, I'm like, back from whom? You want to take it back to what? How far back do you want to go? Like Gil Scott Heron, everybody wants to go back even if it's as far as yesterday. So what do we want to go back to? Because there's some things that happened in our history that I don't want to go back to. I'm not even talking about enslavement. I'm talking about 50 years ago.
Yeah,
I don't want to go back there.
I would not, for just parenthetically, I would not look at slogans as an index of what people believe. People often mouth slogans without having any idea what they mean, and you know, it's like a lot of John F. Kennedy is used as sloganeering when John F. Kennedy was kind of a conservative Democrat. So I really think that you can always find very, very small numbers of people in any movement who are utterly irresponsible. It does not mean that the movement's ideas and ideals are themselves irresponsible.
I think that if we're going to, put President Barack Obama and critique him fairly, we should understand that when he came into office, we had to get out of the biggest recession since the Great Depression. We had two unfunded wars, which the Government Accounting Office says will cost $3 trillion, which have added tremendously to our debt and deficits. Military spending is at least $600 billion a year. So some of our military commitments are contributing greatly to and these military commitments that this president did not get us in and has been trying to get us out of, are part of the parcel of the issue. Medicare Part D that Bush passed was an unfunded mandate. And this president, under the Affordable Care Act, is trying to slow the cost curve, take $500 billion of spending out of Medicare, and that's a part and parcel of the feature. The individual mandate was funded by the Heritage Foundation or pushed by the Heritage Foundation and luminaries such as Newt Gingrich, was supported by the right until this president began to support it. And so it lends you to say, well, what else could it be when the very same things that other people were for, once this president is for them, now people all of a sudden against it. So I think that's more of a fair and balanced assessment of what's really going on and trying to figure out, I would like for someone to answer to me, well, why is it that people are so against the president when he's for the same things they were for until he got into office?
I'm going to open the phones here, but one of the things I will say about the critics of the Affordable Care Act is that it does nothing to contain the cost of health care.
Right.
Nothing. I mean,
the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
Right.
And nothing's been done before it. Nothing's done in the middle of it. Nobody's even talking about that now.
But the claim is it exacerbates.
But I think there's a way that
I'm not sure it exacerbates it either. I think that if it does anything, nothing is being done to control insurance companies raising rates.
That's what
on
I'm
people.
Saying. Yes.
Well, that's not the Affordable Care Act. That's just not happening anywhere.
It's partially the Affordable Care Act.
I wish it was, but it's not.
Well, but in fact, today, with all the difficulty in registering for the Affordable Care Act, you have to be registered to learn what the competitive premiums are for different insurers. So they get you in there, and it's a crazy system. I know you can now say that they regret it, but the fact is that the premiums have been assessed by all sorts of disinterested observers as being far higher, sometimes by as much as 100%, sometimes 200%, as they were previously. And when people get into the system, they cannot shop for lower premiums until they're in the system. And so the entire system, by all estimations of those who do not have a vested interest in the matter, claim that we're talking about a much more expensive insurance system. And how could it be otherwise when everything is insured? I mean, again, Mark, you know that,
right,
that my particular expertise on the Affordable Care Act is mostly in the area of
psychiatry. Yeah, let's not go there, please.
My point is, when I say everything's covered, that's an example of where everything is covered.
Though it's not, because unless you get the gold-plated special in the Affordable Care Act, your mental health care coverage is not as good as if you get the other parts back. So it's not covered in everything, Rick. You're wrong about that, and you're just wrong. I mean, with all due respect,
you can say I'm wrong, but all of the descriptions in the Affordable Care Act indicate that everything, virtually everything, is covered under the
everything is covered to a point. But if you don't get the premium.
Right.
Yeah, but
not.
It doesn't.
If you can't afford that, then it's not covered.
Right. But every
unless it's out of your pocket,
every DSM category is covered.
We're not going there right now, Rick.
All right. But I want to take it back to something that Rick said about even being able to get into the system. I think that last minute decision to have people sign up first, get an account, prove that you actually belong here, prove that you can be on the system, to me, kind of collapsed the whole thing. You don't design a website and then decide right before you roll it out to add this huge step, because people who don't really go on the internet a lot, we're starting to talk about the technological divide, are having a difficult time. So we have this one step that you have accomplished, and then you have to wait. So perhaps we need to look and see how it's going to be getting through the system itself.
Well, this is
to see if it's going to work.
Let's go to the phones here. Let's see if you have a quick thought, Lawrence.
Well, I just think it's very funny that, when the professor says, prove to the system, you know, again, it goes back to the notion that people have to prove who they are in this country. You know, we don't, we're not willing to extend benefits, you know, to everyone that lives in this country. And that, to me, would have been the simplest way. Truly universal, single-payer health care.
That's where we should have gone.
That's what should have happened.
As Sheldon writes in, then we'll go to Russ and Bruce. Sheldon writes in all likelihood, the administration will require millions of additional dollars to fix health care exchange computer systems, see Computer System Development Internal Revenue Service. So where will you get the money? Let's see. Under the Constitution, all appropriation bills originate in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, the House of Representatives. Before you get the call, go ahead.
Which just means
that's right.
Let me go back to the battle to fix the computer system.
I have to say that when the government always gives contracts to the lowest bidder. This is a universal problem that applies to healthcare and a million other things.
And university systems and everything else.
Everything else. When they give, they always think that when they give the bid to the lowest bidder, that they're doing something that is going to be functional. When it turns out that what they get is what they pay for, and this is the case in Affordable Healthcare
Act,
and virtually everything else they do.
Right. I think As I think that what's going to happen here with the Affordable Health Care Act, and we'll go to the phones, and the first caller up is going to be Russ, and then go to Bruce, and then whoever's writing in at steinershow@gmail.com and tweeting us at Mark Steiner, is that when you look at what happened with Medicare and Medicaid especially, when it was passed, it took 30 years for the most conservative states in America to accept Medicaid. People argue that with the Affordable Health Care Act, whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, it'll take another 30 years or 25 years for every state to come in and make it work. That's how the curve has always worked historically in America. That's how it's going to work with this probably. And that battle's going to take place over the next 30 years. So 410-319-8888, quick break. We'll come right back to Russ.